Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege once again to present Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics detective who over the years has crusaded very heroically against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, it's always a pleasure.
In the latest issue of your newsletter, From the Wilderness, and Mike, remind me to give the particulars concerning your newsletter, website, etc., before we leave this broadcast. You update a number of different stories that we've touched on in the past, and I'd like to update those yet again, and to discuss a couple of, several class action lawsuits that you've been involved with, and also some devastating information concerning the economics of the Housing and Urban Development Department and the crack cocaine story that came out in connection with the Contra War. Mike, let's start with the Tyree suit, a lawsuit brought by a former Green Beret named Bill Tyree. We've spoken about that in the past, and so certainly that'll be familiar to some listeners. Let's review a few of the basics, though, for people that might be tuned in for the first time. Tell us about Bill Tyree and Operations Watchtower and Orwell.
Bill Tyree is a former U.S. Army Special Forces troop who served in the 70s with the 7th Special Forces Group down in Panama at the Southern Command. And he was on a number of missions run by the CIA called the Watchtower missions, in which the CIA ordered Special Forces troops into northern Colombia to plant radio beacons so that planes full of cocaine could fly below radar and land undetected at Albrook Field in Panama. At the end of these missions, Tyree was a helicopter crew chief, which did the insertions of the green beanies, we call them. And at the end of these missions, the cocaine was offloaded, and present at the offloading of these aircraft were Manuel Noriega, then a colonel, an Israeli Mossad agent named Michael Harari, and the missions were run by a variety of Special Forces colonels, most of whom are now dead under mysterious circumstances, including Bo Baker, Ed Cutolo was down there, Colonel Ed Cutolo, and a number of other guys who were all now mysteriously dead. Tyree, in 78, after having left the Army for a while, reenlisted and wound up with the 10th Special Forces Group airborne at Fort Devens in Massachusetts, and was participating in a series of missions called the Orwell, Operation Orwell, which involved electronic surveillance, wiretapping, bugging, blackmail, and physical surveillance of political figures throughout the New England area, guys like Tip O'Neill, Ted Kennedy, and so forth, to make sure that the details of the CIA drug missions were kept silent and boxed in, so to speak, and controlled. He didn't want to participate in those missions anymore because they were highly illegal. He was kind of losing his stomach for the rampant illegality. And his wife, Elaine, who was also in the Army, became an informant for Army CID and was keeping diaries. And very suddenly in January of 1979, she was murdered, nearly beheaded, and her diaries were stolen. Bill Tyree was framed for that murder, of which he is totally innocent. He has a great number of alibis. The case was initially thrown out of court, and he has been serving a life sentence in prison now for 20 years, and he's involved in a number of actions at the moment, especially as a result of information that I've been partially instrumental in getting to him and his lawyers, to both sue the government, the CIA, George Bush, Bill Clinton, civilly for all the damages, and also to secure a new trial.
Now, some of the interesting defendants in this case are not responsible. We've discussed this in the past, but there has been a relatively slow response on the part of some of the defendants.
Very slow response, with a couple of real non-sequitur-type head-scratchers that make you wonder what's going on.
And review the defendants again for the benefit of members of the listening audience.
The lawsuit was for $65 million filed in U.S. District Court in Massachusetts, and boy, I don't have the exact date in front of me. I covered it in my newsletter. I believe it was last September.
It was last September, I think it was 4th. It was the Friday before Labor Day weekend when it was filed.
Okay. And the defendants were, in no particular order, of course, the Central Intelligence Agency, George Herbert Walker Bush, who was CIA director when the Watchtower missions were run and, of course, was deeply involved in the CIA in the years since, the current sitting president, William Jefferson Clinton, who has a much larger role than just his officio position as the current president. He was involved as the governor of Arkansas with the CIA receipt of the drugs, if you will, and transportation into Mena, Arkansas. Two Massachusetts officials who were instrumental in the cover-up and framing of Tyree, one of whom is now governor, Paul Cellucci, the other who is now Attorney General Scott Harshbarger, who were both local officials and directly involved in the frame-up of Tyree.
And Oliver North as well, correct?
Oliver North, William Weld, and there are about 120 good et als in there.
Uh-huh. Of course, George Herbert Walker Bush is the father of the fellow who's currently the odds-on favorite to get the Republican nomination. So this is something that is very much au courant as far as the contemporary political scene. Now, George Herbert Walker Bush had not responded last I heard. Has he responded to the suit since then?
Still has not. And the U.S. District Court, in spite of motions, which you're entitled to do, you know, if you file a lawsuit and the defendants don't answer after a certain period of time, you're perfectly allowed, it's law, that you can ask for summary judgment and just get your damages awarded. But the court is stalling on that. And it's very interesting that the U.S. attorney, who by law is can and able and legally empowered to represent, of course, the CIA, which and it has filed responses on behalf of the CIA, is not representing many of the other people who it could represent, like Bill Clinton and like George Bush and Oliver North, because they were all acting in their capacities as government officials.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not representing them and has specifically said so in court, so they need to come up with their own attorney. But when Bill Tyree, just about a month ago, asked for a summary judgment, because it's been now like 9 months and they haven't responded to the subpoenas,
mm-hmm.
The U.S. attorney, who is not representing them, said they need more time.
They've had 9 months.
But he was representing them even though he's not representing them. You see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
But and the court, for some reason, allowed that to happen. So Bill is continuing to fight those battles. They're just dragging tooth and nail, and we anticipated that from the start. We know it's a very strong suit, and if it ever gets to a jury, we'll win. Bill will win, certainly. But Bill is also fighting on other fronts now. He will have soon, actually tomorrow, the 12th. It's tomorrow, the 12th. We are taping on the 11th.
Yes,
say
this,
that.
This is the 11th. Tomorrow is July 12th, for the record.
He will have another hearing in a Massachusetts court to have a hearing for a new trial motion. And he has a pretty decent judge, and he's had to cross a lot of T's and dot a lot of I's, because this particular judge is regarded as a very fair and intelligent and good jurist who appears to be wanting to give Billy a fair chance. And if and when tomorrow the judge rules that he will hear a motion for a new trial, we're hoping that's the case, then a whole slew of hot evidence, some of which we have discussed on your show, which would be the Carone affidavits.
We'll get to the Carone family in just a sec.
Yeah, those will be admitted into evidence along with a letter which is partially authenticated at this point, and I'll be happy to go into that, authored by William Casey on the letterhead of Director of Central Intelligence and witnessed by Richard M. Nixon, written in late 1985, which discusses in detail the agency's role in drug trafficking.
We're going to touch on that in just a second. However, before we leave the issue of counsel, one of the people who had conducted some hearings in the late 1980s that had uncovered a lot of the information about the Contra drug traffic was none other than Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Now, his name has cropped up in connection with this case, and he, as I recall, is going to be getting a U.S. attorney, or federal representation, I should
say. Yes, he was the U.S. Senate passed a resolution, which I covered in my newsletter, to have a senator represent him because he has been subpoenaed in the case, and records which he holds have been subpoenaed. And it's interesting to note that one who is as widely regarded as being a good guy, a white hat on this issue, as John Kerry, was in fact in a very reversed role when Bill Tyree was arrested and indicted 20 years ago. John Kerry then was a young assistant district attorney in Middlesex County, Massachusetts, who, after the original arrest of Tyree and the original filings, was thrown out of court. Judge Killiam said there was absolutely no probable cause to hold Bill Tyree. He thought the murderer was Earl Michael Peters, another Special Forces guy. Threw the case out of court. It was young DA John Kerry who took the whole case, rewrote it, refiled it, and got it filed with the Massachusetts State Judicial Supreme Court. So So John Kerry, in a, you know, was playing the role of making sure that Tyree went to prison.
And it is surprising to hear that from the standpoint of a researcher who is familiar with Kerry only in his persona as someone that did quite a bit to unearth some of these connections with the Kerry Committee of the 80s.
Absolutely true. Now, what's in question here, and this is also very interesting, but this is also very telling. Many people are inclined to say that the Kerry Committee hearings of, what, 10, 11 years ago now, were like brave, courageous, and bold, were wonderful and detailed and heroic, even though not successful in exposing the CIA's horrible role. And there are others like me who think, but yeah, but they only went, they only showed us half the ugly picture. And, you know, there may have been deals made. I think John Kerry certainly wanted to do the right thing in those hearings, but I also think, like any politician, in order to survive, he made deals. What was subpoenaed for the Tyree lawsuit were the records of the Senate investigation from Kerry's Subcommittee on Narcotics and International Terrorism. Now, Kerry has claimed senatorial privilege, that this is stuff we heard in closed session that was classified. But this is also stuff that in open session he said, well, the record stated this and the record stated that, and the minute he does that in open session, it's fair game. And he has done so for the materials that have been subpoenaed. He has admitted their existence and referred to them in open session.
Now, earlier we alluded to the Carone family and in a number of previous interviews about the Tyree case. And by the way, let me state again that with regard to a lot of these allegations, neither myself nor KFJC nor any of the stations that carry this program is actually in possession of any information that would incriminate any of these people. So I'm going to refer to the statements as allegations. And as we have in the past, that's not in any way to dump on you, but simply to clarify that for legal purposes. Now, in the past, Mike, we've visited with D. Carone Ferdinand, who's the daughter of Colonel Albert Carone, a fascinating figure, an individual with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard, and a person whose activities run from the pre-World War II period in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn and the organized crime milieu that called that home, right on up through the Second World War, the Cold War, the Contra War, the war on drugs, the war with drugs, and a whole lot of other things, including the assassination of President Kennedy. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, Albert Carone, some of the things that he did, and also how he came to be connected to the Tyree case.
Al Carone was a born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and he was a young child in the 30s coming up. He was a teenager. I think he was about 19 years old around the start of World War II, 1920. He was raised in Vito Genovese's controlled neighborhood. Vito lived right down the block. Al came from a very broken home. His mother occasionally turned tricks and left him outside to sleep at night while she was making money, so to speak. Vito Genovese took sympathy on this kid and let him work in the Vito's bar and so on. And Vito, of course, working with OSS, was sent back into Sicily in 1943. To prepare the way for the U.S. invasion. And, of course, Vito was you know, a mafia capo. And Al Carone, at the start of the war, joined the Army and was immediately placed in OSS. So he was immediately working and walking both sides of the street.
OSS, by the way, was the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency, with which, among others, William Casey also served. Go ahead,
Mike. Absolutely correct.
Go ahead, Mike.
So after the war, Al came out and he was told by the family, go join NYPD. And he did with the blessing and, of course, what became CIA. So Al was one of the prime interfaces who walked in both worlds. It's kind of like that scene from Chinatown where Faye Dunaway is going, she's my sister, she's my daughter. Well, Al was both a cop and made mafia and CIA all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And he held that role for many, many years. He was a principal bagman for NYPD from the mafia, very close to and involved with the French Connection cases, the Prince of the City cases, and walked the line. And he routinely and regularly throughout his career, he retired in 66, would on occasion don the army of a U.S. Don the uniform, excuse me, of a U.S. Army officer. He was in counterintelligence corps, military intelligence,
and rose to the rank of colonel.
Rose ultimately to the rank of full colonel. That's correct. And go on special missions where he would deliver monies, and he was like a paymaster who would go all over the world for special operations, and the level of his penetration, the level of his work, so to speak, is attested to by the fact that he was in Dallas on November 21st and 2nd of 1963. And this is a correction, by the way, to one of your earlier broadcasts. I was talking to Dee the other day, and we straightened something out.
Okay.
We had said on one of your earlier broadcasts that he was on a rooftop at Love Field with a rifle but could not get a shot.
Mm-hmm.
We had compressed two things, and neither Dee nor Ray Coleman caught it until we replayed the broadcast recently, and they both said, oh, please tell Dave to correct this.
Okay.
He was at Love Field.
Right.
Where the order was issued to the U.S. military intelligence group in the region to stand down.
Right.
And that was somehow confused with couldn't get a shot off. Where he was when he couldn't get a shot off was on the roof of the Texas School Book Depository.
Oh. So, which is a long way from the airport, but
yes.
Quite an interesting place to be. Professor Peter Dale Scott has pointed out the interesting maneuvering around the Texas School Book Depository at that time of various military intelligence and Army intelligence and Army Reserve intelligence agents, and they may very well have been working with Colonel Caron. Review briefly one of the most fascinating details of Caron's career for us, Mike, the Amadeus connection, if you would.
Amadeus, according to all the research I have done, and by the way, there is I have a lot of full and detailed reports on Albert Caron available from my website. It's one of my publications,
mm-hmm.
From the Wilderness Publications. Al Caron worked under one of his primary missions was to work under an umbrella group of operations referred to as Amadeus. Historically, which traced back to the Second World War, the Odessa missions, which was the extraction of the Italian and German SS troops through southern Italy or through Italy into South America to the United States, but which changed and evolved, and those missions evolved into the early drug trading in South America from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And under those umbrellas also were assassinations, wet missions, various political operations, and so forth. And Al Caron was the paymaster for Amadeus, and Amadeus came to be and was widely known to be under the control of George Bush.
By the way, clarifying for listeners who may be new to the concept, Odessa is an abbreviation for the post-World War II SS Underground, and they worked very closely with U.S. intelligence. A lot of them were evacuated by U.S. intelligence to Latin America. That's the reference there. It's not to the Black Sea port.
No.
The fascinating, well, they're like the fascinating thing, as though there was only one fascinating thing about Al Caron, is an individual who touches a lot of bases. As you said, Mike, in an off-air conversation one time, if you study national security affairs in this country, you knew that somewhere there had to be someone like Caron with those kinds of connections. And now he has turned up. He died under strange circumstances in 1990, yet is still listed as active duty, correct?
He died. Al Caron lost his taste for all of the work, lost his time. This is a man who was a murderer, who had done all sorts of evil things and was capable of it all. He lost his stomach for the work in 1985, and I strongly believe, and I have yet to nail this down to the point where I can publish it, but I strongly believe it had to do with a secret returnee program involving U.S. POWs from Southeast Asia, some of which I believe we ultimately killed. But he was also involved in a series of missions in Mexico, one of which resulted in the murder of Kiki Camarena, the DEA agent, in 1985. And he just lost his stomach for it completely in 85, 86. And one day, suddenly, after a meeting with Mossad agent Michael Harari in New Mexico, where he was living at the time, close to his family and daughter, he came down with very serious illness, which was diagnosed. It took him 4 years to die, very painful, but it attacked first the frontal lobes and the left side of his brain, which is how he talked and communicated, which was written by a number of doctors and described as chemical toxicity of unknown etiology. The CIA flu is what we call it, but it's, it was just, hey, he was poisoned and we have no idea how it was done.
And about the only thing we should be grateful for in that regard was that they didn't terminate, or if in fact he was killed, as most people believe. They at least took enough time so that he was able to relay some key aspects of his career, because he's a critical element of American history.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question about why they just didn't take him out suddenly. But this was a man, you have to understand, who lived his whole life in the world of conspiracy, in the world of if they do this, I will do this, and multi-level depths of contingency planning. So they had known that he had a number of time bombs that, hey, if I get shot on a street, you do this, you do this, you do this. But since the illness was protracted and over a long period of time, it gave them, unfortunately, or fortunately, time to forestall, because he wasn't dead, his time bombs couldn't go off, but they were slowly neutralizing him. But it also gave them time to watch how he, through his daughter, set about to protect the information that he thought would take care of his family. I would give him about a grade of a D or a C on that, because right after he died, all of his bank accounts were erased, including the joint bank accounts he held with his daughter. His driver's license disappeared, his NYPD records disappeared, his military records disappeared. The man was erased from the face of the earth in all of the history books. D was able to hold on to plenty of records, which I first saw in 1994. But all the money was taken away, and the Army said that Al Caron did not exist after World War II and had never risen to a rank higher than staff sergeant, which was how he was buried in a New Mexico cemetery. I went to see Dee in 1994, and she's one of my dearest friends. I mean, she's been wonderfully honest with me, and the whole family has been put through absolute hell because of what happened. I mean, $30,000, $40,000 in medical bills suddenly fell due on the daughter. I mean, and all the insurance policies disappeared. Everything disappeared. So I reviewed the records and realized that this was a man who was at the heart of everything. And this, in his address book, and I'll say this statement correctly, which had a number of papers in it also, I found the home address and phone number for William Casey in Long Island, who was a very close friend of the family. Bill Casey had been to Al Caron's grandson's christening, to Dee's son's christening, in New York City in 1970.
And in our interview with Dee Caron, also with Ray Coleman, Bill Tyree's attorney, and yourself, we spoke about how William Casey had passed stock tips to Al Caron and turned to pass on to the mob. Of course, Casey had served as Richard Nixon's director of the Securities and Exchange Commission, so he was in a position to get those tips.
And Al Caron was the interface between a number of politicians, including one who's now running for president from Utah, and the organized crime families and the CIA guys, because that was how a lot of money was made. And the agency made money, too, by telling people, hey, place your bets on this. This is where it's coming up.
And, of course, Casey was director of CIA for most of Ronald Reagan's first term. And Al Caron was involved in a number of the Contra-related operations as well, including some of their precursors, such as Watchtower, which brings us to how he came to be connected to the Tyree case.
Exactly. And in the same phone book, while I'm sitting there going through these records that Dee was able to save, I find the home address and phone number for Paulie Castellano, who was head of the Gambino family. And there were names much more esoteric that you and I would know at the drop of a hat, but, you know, the listeners might not. But as I looked at these names, I realized we had the board of directors of the Nugenhan Bank. Bill Colby should be a familiar name. He turned up frequently. There were tons of records to prove that Al Caron was not only there, but that he was at the highest levels.
By the way, the Nugenhan Bank was a joint CIA naval intelligence operation involved with, among other things, massive complicity in the drug trade.
In Australia, absolutely correct.
Yep.
So I said to Dee at that point, trying to help her out, just to help the family recover from the horrible weight that had been dropped on them, that there was only one man who I thought she could contact who would help her, and it turned out that she had known the name through Al Caron, who talked frequently about knowing people like George Bush, Oliver North, Elliot Abrams, and who was the bag man for most of the Contra cocaine money at Oliver North's and George Bush's direction. But that man was Ted Shackley, who was a retired associate deputy director of operations, ADDO as we call it, but of CIA, who was like Mr. Covert Operations, but who has also been central to CIA's drug trafficking role since Southeast Asia in the 60s, right up through Iran-Contra. Shackley ran the Miami station and the liaison between the CIA and the mafia in the 60s, where the agency worked with Sam Giancana and Santos Traficante, both of whom were Dee's uncles. And so I said, call Shackley. And she had known Shackley's name, and she tracked him down. And the interesting part about this, which was a proof positive for a lot of us, was that she got a hold of Shackley, laid out the story, and less than 10 days later, Al Caron's headstone was changed from staff sergeant to full colonel. And Dee has a copy of the order directing that change, and she knows that Shackley arranged for that to happen.
Now, we have about 2 to 3 minutes on this side of the tape, Mike. D. Caron came into a very interesting letter, which, well, actually, before we get into that, fill us in how D learned that her father had been involved with the Tyree case. We'll get to the letter in the next side of the tape.
Okay. Very briefly, back when Elaine Tyree was murdered, and in the times, in the years before, Al Caron had talked frequently about a young guy that he had, with whom he had been on missions, named Sandy, who was with the Special Forces, who was a bright up-and-comer, who had a lot of courage, who could be a leader, you know, who had everything that it took. That was all she knew, was the name Sandy. And then around 79, around the time of Elaine's murder, 78, 79, Sandy was in a lot of trouble, and he was getting it put to him by the guys at the CIA and the Army, and Big Al Caron was worried about him. Dee never heard anything more about this guy, Sandy, except for he had a great sense of humor, and he was a kidder, and he was in Special Forces, and then Sandy went to prison. Well, for years, that was all Sandy Dee ever knew. Now, right after the murder, Dee's husband, Tommy, had seen Al Caron with a set of diaries, which were Elaine's diaries, but again, the name Tyree or Sandy was never mentioned, and he had seen Al Caron reading them and I believe actually discussed some of the contents, and Al had turned those over to CIA. It wasn't until years after my research, and I'm in Dee's life, another investigator who is now passed, Bill McCoy, was involved, that we start talking about Tyree. Now, of course, Dee's maiden name is Caron, but her married name is Ferdinand. So I would be talking about Dee Ferdinand to an investigator, Bill McCoy, who's working with Tyree, and Dee would have remembered Sandy but never heard the name connected with Bill Tyree from me. And it was not until a report that I wrote on Al Caron got published in a magazine that got to Bill Tyree that he saw Dee Caron Ferdinand talking about Al Caron that he made the connection. And subsequently, we found out with Ray Coleman and so forth that the Sandy that Al Caron was talking about was, in fact, William Tyree, the Special Forces guy in prison in Massachusetts. And Dee and Billy Tyree connected in, I think it was late 96. And boy, the sparks have been flying since then, because we now have proof in the form of witness statements and affidavits that the diaries existed and were retrieved. We know there was an illegal search in which the diaries were taken in Massachusetts, because Massachusetts authorities have confessed and pled guilty to a civil charge of unlawful search and seizure and removal of property, to wit, the diaries. Mm-hmm. So we pretty much have CIA over the barrel here, because we know where the diaries went now, and we have witnesses who will testify to that and produce other evidence in court.
And it was Al Caron who retrieved the diary.
Absolutely correct.
All right, Mike, we're going to resume once again with the fascinating tale of the Tyree case and a new development involving some of those same people, the Caron family, Dee Caron and William Casey, in our next half hour. That, however, concludes this half hour. We've been visiting with Mike Rupert, and for Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.